Welcome to IKRADIA, where we meet experts and practitioners at the front lines of sustainable architecture and urbanism. My name is Nirmal Krishnani. I'm a sustainable design strategist, author, and educator based in Singapore. This is the third webinar in our limited series organized in collaboration with the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. This series is a unique opportunity to meet the recipients of the Holcim Awards 2023, which were announced in Venice in November last year. So each month, I sit down with two award winners who will walk us through their design processes and share their sustainability journeys in their part of the world. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Lei Quang, who is principal at Lei Quang Architects in Berlin, Germany. Their project, the Post-COVID Factory, won the Holcim Award 2023 acknowledgement for the Asia-Pacific region. Joining him is Chris Helston. Chris is the Living Building Challenge Services Director at Miller Hall Partnership in Seattle in the US. Their project, Maritime Innovation Center, won the Holcim Awards 2023 Silver for the North American region. This webinar series is sponsored by the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation was created in 2003 to empower a community of future makers through the transfer of ideas, knowledge, and real-world solutions. The Holcim Foundation today delivers on all these fronts with a treasure trove of information on its website. You can find all past winners of the Holcim Awards from all over the world and discover the strategies they followed on their journey towards sustainability. Go to holcimfoundation.org to find out more. So Quang, Chris, welcome to IKRADIA. It's a great pleasure to meet you both again. We first met in Venice for the Holcim Awards 2023. Today, I want to discuss your respective winning projects and what connects them both. The question that affects the industrial workspace is one of balancing well-being of the occupant, the worker, against the efficiency of the workflows. So the COVID pandemic, I think, taught us that health and economic considerations are intertwined, right? And for the industrial workspace, there is no work from home. And so the answer lies in a rethink of the industrial typology. So let's dive into the two projects. Chris, you're an architect and a Living Building Challenge Service Director based in Seattle, USA. The jury for North America in awarding your team a silver had much praise. Now, jurors noted the adaptive reuse approach, the repurposing of an existing 100-year-old building, the exceptional energy efficiency achieved by balancing passive and active systems, the integration of many different programs within a very compact volume, thereby optimizing land use and promoting community life. Quang Lei, you are also an architect, but based in Berlin, Germany. The jury awarded your team an acknowledgement for the Asia-Pacific region. The jurors singled out the repurposing of industrial sites, the quest for better indoor and outdoor work environment, a dense yet permeable massing with green space. They noted the project's approach to harmonizing agriculture with industry, which begins to reimagine Vietnam's industrial landscape. Before we get into the conversation, please walk me through your projects. Let's start with you, Quang.
Yes, our factory project is part of the holistic industrial master plan that we developed in South Vietnam. This was an old agricultural city in the past. Our concept focused on developing a new type of industrial zone that is ecologically friendly and reasonable in land use management. By placing the multiple agricultural landscape in the center, we are planning the traffic flow and approach of the logistic vehicle in the more efficient way. The building density is reduced, but it still ensures the benefit of the client. The first construction project starts here. By carefully studying the production line, we optimize the building footprint in a strategy that smaller is better, leaving more space for the agriculture land. These agriculture cultures become a kind of socialization spaces, helping to improve the quality of the working environment for workers. In addition, it also regulates the climate, cooling, and filter the rainwater. We named this factory is a post-COVID factory because after the pandemic, we recognize the factory here in Vietnam is not only for working and making blast profit, it also needs a certain concern about a new type of ventilation, comfort, cooling, and working environment. Thanks.
Thank you, Quang. I mean, I've been to Dong Nai, and It is a very intensive industrial landscape. I mean, it's one of the largest industrial areas in Southeast Asia. More than half of the population actually work in factories. So I'm really curious to see how you address the question of well-being. We'll come to that in a minute. Would you summarize your proposal now, Chris?
Sure. The Maritime Innovation Center is the Port of Seattle's oldest building at about 110 years. The project is approximately 14,000 square feet, and it's part of the working waterfront just north of downtown Seattle, Washington, located in what's known as Fisherman's Terminal. For years, the building has been underutilized, but the port believed that its life wasn't over. So Miller Hull and our expert team of consultants are renovating the building to provide office, conference, and educational space to support a nonprofit tenant working to create a blue economy, the greening of the shipping industry with things like hybrid ships and green-collar workforce. The Maritime Innovation Center is pursuing the Living Building Challenge, the world's most stringent green building rating system. This requires a project to operate at net positive energy and net positive water, and to prove its performance for at least a year's worth of occupancy. This all-electric building, powered entirely by photovoltaics, will have a host of efficiency and performance features, including full gray and black water treatment system. The project will comply with the strict requirements of prohibiting red list chemicals. This is the most common and toxic ingredients in our building products and materials. And improvements in daylighting, natural ventilation, and indoor air quality will create a healthier working environment in the building for scores of fishers and other maritime professionals.
Thank you, Chris. I am somewhat familiar with the LBC, Living Building Challenge, and I have questions for you on how you achieved it, because it is an incredibly stringent target. But let's take a step back for a minute. Tell me a little bit about the context of your project. I mean, Quang, I talked about Dong Nai as this kind of industrial landscape. Tell me a little bit about where this building is situated. And what is the nature of the work that takes place inside the building?
So Dong Nai is one of the biggest industrial zones in South Vietnam. Actually, before it was, I mean, long time ago, it has been agriculture area, which is produced like a lot of rice and food for the people, but because of the development process, you know, so day by day it's become more industrial zone than the agricultural zone. So as a result of that process, you know, like, I think it's good because it provides more work, you know, more job, more income for the local people here. But in the same time, is we have some trouble about the ground contamination and the work environment, because it is kind of difficult for people to switch from from the farmer to be like a worker with such an intensive process, you know. So this is the context of our project. And for the factory we built is for the wooden furniture manufacturer. Production.
Okay, yep. So it's quite a sizable building. It's 26,000 square meters, almost occupying the entire site. The Maritime Innovation Center is a fraction of this, less than a tenth. Chris, can you tell me a little bit about the building and what it contains and where it is situated?
Yeah, we're not quite as industrial as Laquang's project there. We're a small industrial neighborhood, but kind of situated between some residential neighborhoods within Seattle. And it is a working waterfront. That's what's unique about this particular project. The Port of Seattle has long held this land and is currently occupied by quite a fishing industry here that works along this waterfront. So the building is in a really active location, and it's just been run down over the recent years. So it's really great to see the Port of Seattle's commitment to bring this back, which will now become this hub for really innovation for the new economy, really helping to green their entire fleet and kind of protect the very waters that these fishers work in. So it's really exciting to see this transformation of one of their oldest projects.
What does a hub mean? I mean, is it an industrial space with laboratories and workshops, or is it an office space? I mean, what is the nature of the work that takes place inside this building?
It's a little bit of both. Yeah. So they're going to have some industrial space to help incubate some other maritime businesses as they're getting off the ground and developing some of these new technologies like hybrid shipping and things like that. And it certainly is an office component and conference space as well. It's intended to be a meeting area for the entire Fisherman's Terminal. There will likely be many different events that are hosted here publicly with the Port of Seattle and the various fishing community events that happen. So right. A little bit of everything.
Right. So, I mean, what stands out about both your projects is the emphasis on occupant and well-being and community. Before we get into the details of that, I want to ask this question of what was it like at the early stage of design? How did you make a case to your client to incorporate these considerations? I mean, a lot of industrial buildings are, you know, commercially owned and therefore very profit-oriented. I mean, how did you flip the script, as it were? Quang, Vietnam, particularly challenging, right? How did you talk to your client? What was the thinking there that allowed you to do what you had to do?
I guess in my case, actually, it's quite different, like the normal case, because the client come to us and asking that, because, you know, like during the, as you mentioned before, like for COVID, there is no work from home for the worker, you know, so they locked down and everyone just going back to their hometown. And then after the lockdown, it's so difficult for all the factories to have them back, you know, because they just stay there, you know. So that's why the client, they came to us and they just giving the requirement, like, can you do like a new type of factory giving the better working environment? But it has to be at the same cost as they invested before. Yeah. So it is what happened to me. Yeah.
But so what you're saying then is that the client saw well-being and the worker welfare as a way of attracting and retaining workers post-COVID. When people were reluctant to come back to factories, they saw this attribute of the building as a way of kind of attracting people back in. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And I have to say, like, sometimes we have to wait such a thing like the pandemic to have that kind of mentality from the client, which is, I think, is quite late. But anyway, it's, at least they start to think about that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, everywhere in the world, the COVID pandemic has made us rethink what it means to be in a work environment. Chris, talk a little bit about the early conversations with the client. Why such an emphasis on well-being and community engagement, and how does that integrate with the workflow and the productivity of that environment?
Yeah, for us, we were fortunate to really be bolstered by the Port of Seattle's Century Agenda, they call it. They had this ambitious goal to become really what is the greenest port in North America. That's their specific requirements. So when we first heard about that, it really just kind of made sense to align with something like the Living Building Challenge. We're fortunate enough to have the most experience with this of any architect in the world. We have 6 certified living building projects now. And so when we think about something that becomes the greenest for a particular client, that really aligns with something that has proven performance like Living Building Challenge, where we can show exactly what we can do by using natural resources to power the building, to treat its own water, and then really provide, as you say, some healthy requirements for the tenants there. And we knew that that was an important criteria there. And Living Building Challenge has long been aligned with those types of requirements, focusing on natural ventilation, really healthy indoor air requirements, and all these things that we now are having a much greater emphasis on now that we've gone through a pandemic.
Right. It's interesting. In a funny sort of way, both your projects are driven by its context, right? I mean, in the case of the Maritime Innovation Center, it was driven by the Port of Seattle's broader agenda to be a green port. In Quang, in your case, the factory was really trying to set itself apart from other factories by providing a different kind of work environment. That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the specific features and strategies that simultaneously address the operational needs of the factory or that space, the environmental performance, and occupant well-being. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what you did, and were these different drivers in sync, or were there times when, say, operational workflow was at odds with environmental impact? You know, and if so, what were the conflicts and how did you resolve it? Let's start with you, Chris. Well, give me an example of some of the strategies that you deployed and how that kind of fit into the larger scheme.
Sure. Well, we're guided by the Living Building Challenge framework for this particular project. If you're not familiar, the idea is really to have buildings that mimic a natural element. A flower is what they use. So thinking about how a building can really operate completely from all the energy that falls on it, gather all the water that it's needed for it, really kind of meeting the carrying capacity of the site. And so that's really what kind of aligned our particular design focus. We've got photovoltaics that are part of this project. So that's the entire energy system. We've got a backup battery system as well for some resilience components. And then the water system is really the most complicated part of the Living Building Challenge these days, making sure that we are being able to collect the rainwater that we need, and then treating all of the gray and black water on site with particular equipment that is housed within the building. And here we had a little bit unique challenge that the Port of Seattle land here is actually built over what's an old estuary. So the ground isn't really set up for kind of this full recharge that we would expect on a more natural site system. So we have to really work with the pre-existing water flows on the site. Living Building Challenge asks us to kind of reimagine what the previous ecology was of a site. And so really working with that industrial transformation today became kind of a challenge, but we were able to find ways to meet that and improve the water quality for the area.
Right, right. But one of the things that struck me about this, the architecture of this building, was the emphasis on passive design. And here, I think, for instance, apart from the metrics of water and energy, the occupant well-being is so much driven by access to daylight and ventilation. So you had a huge polycarbonate facade, really, wasn't it? That kind of one gable facade is all made out of polycarbonate that lets a lot of diffuse light in. Tell me a little bit about how you kind of balance passive and active systems in the climate of Seattle.
Yeah, I think, you know, from a design standpoint, one of our first tenets was really not to mess up what was already there. You know, it has a classic look to this building, over 100 years old. So we really wanted to work with the existing massing, the existing materials, and find a way for it to reflect something that was industrial. So you mentioned the polycarbonate. You know, we don't want anything that's too precious out there. It's a working waterfront. But we want to be able to kind of utilize that daylighting in a new way. The existing building didn't have a lot of access to daylight or natural ventilation. So this reimagines kind of what that can be by keeping the same massing, similar industrial materials, but really focusing on a way that we can now bring that natural light into this working waterfront space and allow the tenants to have operable windows at every space that so that they can influence their own environment and really take advantage of those nice maritime breezes right on the coast there as well.
Mm. No, I think it lends itself to a very a beautiful biophilic interior. And the other thing that, you know, looking at the images of this project, the other thing that stands out is the reuse of materials, a lot of timber. So there is a very strong biophilic component. Again, I guess what I'm asking is how the two objectives kind of synergize. So you have daylighting, but that also reduces operational costs. You have a biophilic material. Talk to me about how you brought these different ideas together into a certain logic.
Yeah, I mean, I think reusing these existing materials is important, certainly from a carbon standpoint. But then, as you mentioned, there's some biophilic quality, certainly, as we all kind of, you know, go towards the idea of seeing wood and natural wood in our projects. And I think those things really help people to be grounded a little bit more. We've certainly heard that from our other projects where people really respond well to kind of seeing the exposed wood, having the connection to their exterior a little bit more, you know, being able to have a view out of their windows, being able to control their own natural environment and get the ventilation and air quality that they need. And I think when people are more grounded to those things, it certainly creates a better wellness for our workspaces.
Sure.
And we feel like those things should be brought to these industrial spaces as well. So those things really seem to go well together.
Right. I mean, I think they apply as a principle. This applies to any building typology, but perhaps particularly so for industrial typology.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if there were moments where the two things were at odds. Did you have situations where you were kind of forced to make a choice or a compromise?
You know, not really in this particular project. I think, you know, the utilizing the existing building really helps. And I think, you know, this is the palette that we have to work with. And instead of trying to cover it up or change materials, really honoring what was there in the past, building buildings out of these strong timber members was really how the waterfront was built 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so being able to continue to utilize those same materials and honor them today, I think didn't really put anything at odds. I think we still, as humans and interested in design, ground towards those natural materials.
Right, right. Kwong, you didn't have so much of a history of the site to work with. I mean, in a way, Dong Nai is very much an industrial landscape. Everything that was there is gone.
Yes,
you know, right. Everything has been rebuilt into something new. So you don't have the legacy of the past. But interestingly, what emerged in the post-COVID factory is a similar approach. There was a strong emphasis on daylighting and ventilation. You talk about harnessing the rain, the wind, and the sun, creating cooling systems for better indoor conditions. Talk me through the thinking of why these elements were so important for indoor comfort.
Yes, I think in our case, you know, the factory in Dong Nai is, and the climate here is quite different with the Chris case, because as you know, like in the Southeast Asia, we have just too much sunlight and too much rainwater, you know. In the same time, I think it's good because we can, you know, I mean, the sun is important and it's kind of interesting to give that kind of quality for the worker. But in our case, we try to block the sun, you know, because the sun here is not only like giving the quality, but it also is warm up for everything.
Right.
So our passage design, you know, we try to block on the direct sun and giving the natural ventilation and the natural light for the worker through the indirect solution. So the sun is going to be heat up the garden, and then from the garden is go inside to the factory. So basically, we cool down the temperature inside the factory shed. And on the another hand, I mean, for the rain, I have to say the rain for us is causing more trouble than the benefit, you know. So we try to having more permeable surface to absorb the water, and we collect as well the rainwater to reuse this. Yeah.
So it led to a strategy of pocket gardens. The architecture is kind of interrupted by these courtyards, they basically reduce the plan depth, so you get good cross ventilation and near daylight, but they also create little pockets of coolness in the overall architecture.
Yes.
That's interesting. I want to know, is either of your projects completed? Have you been able to do a post occupancy audit? Chris, is it completed? Is it occupied?
Not yet. Ours is under construction right now.
Okay, and Kwong, is yours occupied? It is.
Yes. Yeah, for
so let me ask you, Kwong.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done a post-occupancy survey? Do you know if people actually like what you have given them?
Yes, actually, because we do some interview for the local workers there, you know. And by the way, we look at their daily lives, you know. And then we recognize, as you mentioned before, like in Dong Nai, we don't have that much legacy as what Chris had in his area. But personally, I think our legacy is the Dutch people who actually being there, you know. They used to be farmers, which is like kind of the legacy for themselves, you know. So we provide the Dutch culture. It's not only from beautification the project, but also, you know, to because as a farmer, you know, they always like to to farm. I mean, like they're always planting something at their house, you know, on the roof, in the terraces. So we use that courtyard gardening as the healing solution for them. So they feel actually for sure. I think they won't feel better when they are being close to the farm.
Sure, I have questions for you regarding the farming strategy. I think that's a really interesting way to reinterpret landscapes. So we'll come to that. But I just want to know. So you've spoken to the occupants, and they tell you that they like it or that they enjoy it. What about the owner of the building? Have they seen the impact that they intended? Like, for example, is there greater worker retention? Is there greater productivity? I mean, what are the metrics of success here?
Yes, I think basically it's become like the compromise between the owner of the factory and the worker. So as we talked before, like they try to use factory as an attractive yes. point for mm-hmm. the worker, you know. So in the end of the day, they say, okay, for this garden, a group of worker can spend like, I don't know, 2 hours per week or 3 hours per week to, you know, to take care of all that. And very important, like, but somehow, you know, the farmer, they like to eat the vegetable made by themselves, you know, like it's kind of the happiness, like a very traditional happiness. So that's why they won't, I think in the end of the day, they're going to make the deal between the yeah, worker and the owner of the factory. Yep.
It's interesting you talk about happiness. One of your country's best known architects, Huang Tak Hao, I'm sure you've heard of his name. He often talks about an architecture of happiness, and that is about bringing people close to nature, of giving them back this sense of relationship with the natural environment. Chris, I know your buildings aren't completed yet, but what will be the measure of its success?
Well, certainly the Living Building Challenge performance period helps to really guide that. I mean, we'll be monitoring it very closely this first year. You know, day to day, taking readings around energy performance and water performance. Those are certainly some guiding metrics. But then I think longer than that is really just exactly what you're asking Lekwang about is how do people feel about it? Mm-hmm. How is this successful in terms of really being in this incubator space for the client, the tenant that's going to be there, the Maritime Blue? And do people like coming to work there? Do they feel a sense of pride in protecting the very waters that they're serving, the very environment that they're so connected to? Just like with Lekwang, as you say, the people being close to the farms. I think we're experiencing very similar components here, where the fishers are coming right off their vessels and walking right into this to this building and working on things that they're going to take back to their ship and take out to enhance their job, and really being a part of that that community that's rooted in this environment.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but that's an interesting parallel that where Kwang is with his project is trying to bring farming and food production back in. The Maritime Center is also a kind of farming. You're by the sea fishing.
Certainly.
You know, that's,
yeah.
So sustenance, food becomes the common denominator in well-being.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Totally.
Exactly. And there's living building pieces that are, you know, tied to that. They're expanding the availability of people selling directly off of the ships for seafood for the community. Mm-hmm. There's even an urban agriculture component that we've brought these gardens and pea patches to other neighborhoods around the area that'll really expand the farming that's available to them right in the city. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think this is exact. And one more additional thing in Vietnam, you know, for the farmer here, like doing farming is kind of the land ownership mentality, you know. If you do farm somewhere, it means like you belong to the land, or the land belongs mm-hmm. to you. How, yeah, it's how they feel. I mean, like, yeah, if you get to know in history, you know, like the land use, and that mentality is kind of
yeah
quite popular.
I mean, it It's also relevant that Dong Nai used to be a farming community, and so now it's transformed to an industrial condition. I want to ask you, Quang, this idea of bringing farming into an industrial context has been done by other architects before. And here I'm thinking specifically of Vo Trong Nha in Vietnam. I'm sure you know Vo Trong Nha. He's very well known. Vo Trong Nha did a kindergarten in an industrial estate belonging to a factory, where he converted the roof of the kindergarten into a farm. So I asked him, how well used is it? Do they actually grow vegetables? And who looks after it? So let me ask you the same question. Yeah. In this farm that you imagine in the middle of your factory, who's going to look after it? And what happens to the produce when it is produced?
Yes, in our factory, the worker is the main character who taking care for the garden. I think as you look at to the a lot of the project about, you know, one thing I have to say about the agriculture landscape is you don't need that much cost to do the maintenance. You know, like if you build like such a holistic beautiful landscape, you know, you're gonna have someone who take care for that. But for the landscape agriculture, the good point is actually is people gonna, I mean, they have to taking care for that, you know. Yeah. So at least you win the cost. And you know, by the way, I told you before, people, they would love to have their own vegetables.
Yes.
For eating, or you know. So in the end of the day, I think they do it themselves, they use this themselves.
Creates a connection.
Of course, they
yeah.
can.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They create the connection. So it is what I always think the agriculture landscape, as you, yeah, I mean, if you look at the rice field in the summer or in the spring, you know, it's extremely beautiful. And honestly, I mean, you don't have that much people who have to be there every day
yeah.
and
yeah.
Every time.
Yeah, I think that is a common narrative that a lot of people who end up in these industrial estates, and they do it out of necessity because they come there to make a living, but they come from an agricultural past. They come from villages, and they come from places where growing food is a very intuitive kind of everyday affair. I want to ask you, Chris, about Living Building Challenge. Why LBC? It's a really, I've read the details on the Living Building Challenge certification, and it's really hard to achieve. I mean, you know, the red list of materials, for instance, is very difficult to manage. So what made you decide on the Living Building Challenge, and talk me through some of the difficulties that you faced getting there?
Yeah. Well, I've been fortunate to work with Living Buildings since 2009. I did my first project back then with the Birchie School here in Seattle, one of the world's first living buildings, and then just continued to develop that here with Miller Hull. And we now have six projects that are certified in various typologies and around the United States. It really just makes sense. I mean, this is how buildings should be built today. These are something we can achieve. You know, we have the engineering solutions to accomplish what Living Building Challenge asks of us. But it does require a little bit of a change in how we might design or how we think about things. Certainly, there is more of an integrated design aspect. You're asking, you know, conflicts about things and how do these synergies develop. And Living Building really asks us to look at the site a bit more, find out what the context is asking of us, of the ecology, and then making sure that our disciplines working together are really solving these issues simultaneously. We're not working in these vacuums of having a meeting with a structural engineer, and then we go and have a separate meeting with a mechanical engineer. It's about everybody being together with the user group and kind of solving all these design challenges throughout the project. Mm. And for us, a specific one, I think the most challenging is really around the water.
Right.
Again, we have the engineering solutions for these, but oftentimes the jurisdictional requirements are what differs. So we've even dealt with that on this particular project. The original design, as the Living Building asks us to, is to collect all the rainwater that we're going to use for potable needs, to be able to drink the rainwater within the building. And our first designs had that. But since our project was under design, the state of Washington actually changed their guidelines and no longer allows commercial buildings to be able to treat and drink their own rainwater. Although we have other buildings that do that already, they're grandfathered in. So that was a design change that really forced us to look at things a little bit differently through the challenge, but still be able to be efficient with our water use and be able to kind of mimic the original environmental conditions here on site.
Are you familiar, Quang, with the Living Building Challenge?
I think it's quite new for me. Yes.
But let me ask you a question, Quang. You talk about your building being low cost. USD $300 per square meter, yeah, I think you said. Give me a sense of what that is. I mean, how much does the typical factory building in Vietnam cost compared to what you built?
In our case, you know, the 300 USD per square meter is only the cost for building up the massing of the factory, which is basically our factory is just like a shed, you know. So honestly, that cost is quite popular here, you know. They own build everything with that kind of cost, like around 250, 300 USD per square meter. So I have to say, like, our low-cost solution is just about, we build something better, but in the same cost as the normal thing happened here, which is exactly what the clients they expect to do, because our goal is make it perform better.
Right.
Yeah, in the better way. If you work for the Vietnamese client, I have to say you can propose something super cool, you know, super nice. But if the cost is high, or if you need to do extra cost for it, you know, it's going to be very challenging.
So they won't pay more.
Yeah,
what you are able to do is to provide more value for the dollar. That's what you're saying.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
For the same price.
Yeah.
What about you, Chris? Did your approach cost more upfront? Were there returns, you know, over the life of the building? How was cost understood for industrial typology?
Yeah, well, being a public project certainly has public scrutiny around it. And you know, using the public's funds responsibly is something that's really critical with the Port of Seattle here. And so we knew that was going to be a part going into this. For living buildings, typically there is a small premium. They seem to vary depending on the type of building and location. And certainly in Seattle, we unfortunately have a really hot building climate here, and in terms of economy, rather. And so we really are kind of, I guess, struggling with the amount of premium that's placed on construction around here.
Right.
The building industry is very busy here. There really is quite a significant premium to build in the city right now. So balancing those things with the initial costs is one of the struggles that we kind of see on every project. Certainly, we saw a pandemic increase and supply chain disruptions that really changed things quite a bit. But overall, really able to stay within the budget that the port had originally set out. By making these smart choices, reusing existing portions of the building. And then certainly over the lifetime of the building, the port will see a great value in that. I mean, there will be no utility bills for this building. They're not going to pay energy or water costs for them for the life of the building. And for an owner that keeps a project for many years, that really makes a lot of sense to them. They'll get a lot of return on that.
What do you think on the premium of upfront costs? What is the payback on these different systems?
They vary by system. And so certainly the photovoltaic system will pay back in a few years. The water treatment system is going to be longer than that. But there's a greater value in, again, protecting the environment that they're serving, to be able for the fishers to say that they're not running off any storm water that's going to harm the very fish populations they're working in every day, to be able to treat their own water and drink their own water here, and even handle all their waste on site, I think provides this really great sense of responsibility and connection for these people to the very environment they're working in. And of course, the long-term payback that the client will receive is another bonus.
Right. one of the things I find really interesting about the Holcim Awards winners is that notwithstanding the size of the project, there is often a big picture. There is something that the project is setting out to achieve that has ramifications, replicability, or it's going to somehow change the way we think about the typology or we think about construction. What is the big picture here, Chris? I mean, I know your project is a relatively modest size project.
Yeah, I mean, for the Port of Seattle, they've already found some other projects that they're converting into living buildings as well. So they've really taken on this idea, this challenge, and expanded it. And the idea of replicability was certainly an important piece here too. Again, with that goal of becoming the greenest port in North America, they want to show that this is possible. They want to make this a beacon for other ports to follow around the world. Right. So I think that's the idea, is to be able to show that these types of buildings work in industrial waterfront. They make sense for the responsible use of public funding. And again, this is how we can be building buildings.
Right, right. Kwang, what about you? Is anyone copying your approach in Vietnam? Does your project have an impact beyond its own site boundaries?
Yes, I think like at the moment, I don't see anyone who do the same solution that that we have met. I think because not so many architects here, they are not so interested in doing factories, you know. But at least I think we have some new client who giving us a call, you know, so probably we can offer them the design with the same vision as we provide for this project.
Okay. Well, I hope you know, regulations will change or somehow it will trigger a market response, because it would be great to see. Yes. I mean, in you know, in both your cases, for some kind of a ripple effect.
I think I do agree. But, you know, like, but somehow I have to say, like, in Vietnam, architecture is quite limited, you know, like, honestly, we have to wait for the policy, you know.
Yes.
All the thing we do, we're just trying to promote, like, the policy for the new building code, for the new regulation, you know.
Right.
And then I think it's going to be, because factory in the end of the day is huge. I mean, like, we have to face the fact, like, anyway, Dong Nai going to be the industrial zone with a lot of massive building and massive amount of people working there.
Right. Last question, and I like to end every webinar with this, which is, what would you have done differently? Chris?
Yeah, it's always a tough one. I think, you know, having known a little bit about the jurisdictional challenges we would have had with water, we would have simplified the design earlier on with that. You know, but in general, I think we're happy with being able to have this kind of working waterfront building that meets all these performance criteria, and being able to utilize the community to help build it, I think has been something that we see a lot of great promise in, to be replicable for the port. And it's been a great project to be a part of.
Mm. Same question, Kwang. Mm-hmm. If you had one thing to change, what would you have done differently?
Like more or less the same with Chris, like in the end of the day, we are designer, you know. So if I would do it again, I'm going to slightly change the massing of the factory, you know, to be a little bit more efficient. Because back to that day, we don't have that much time to dive into the production line, you know. So at the moment, I think some wing of the building can be slightly smaller. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do probably the better massing for the building
if you had a second go at it. Next factory, the next one.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Well, Kwang, Chris, thank you both for joining me today. It was a great pleasure to have you on EcoGradia. Congratulations again for winning the Holcim Awards 2023.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A big thank you to the sponsor of this series, the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation is a leading organization whose sole mission is to promote new ways of thinking and acting in the design construction sector globally. Their goal is to give you the resources you need to craft your own journey and make that journey a little easier. To learn more about the winning projects discussed in today's webinar, plus who else will be featured in this series, go to wholesomefoundation.org. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, this is Nirmal Kishnani signing off in Singapore.